Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the resignation of the Speaker of the House a day after he hosted Pope Francis and discuss how the first constitutional office written into the Constitution has become an untenable job for a Republican lawmaker who tries to work with other branches of government to get things done for the American people. A veteran senior staffer who spent 28 years in Congress, Mike Lofgren, joins us. He is the author of The Party Is Over, How Republicans Went Crazy, Democrats Became Useless, and the Middle Class Got Shafted. And we will discuss the Tea Party's so-called Freedom Caucus in the House, which Congressman Peter King calls the crazies, and how GOP primary voters at the Values Summit cheered when presidential candidate Marco Rubio announced John Boehner's resignation. Then we'll examine the continuing growth of ISIS, with 30,000 foreign recruits pouring into Syria at the same time that divisions have erupted among U.S. military intelligence analysts who feel that their assessments are being sanitized by the top brass to make it appear that U.S. efforts to degrade and destroy ISIS are more successful than the reality on the ground indicates. Richard Barrett, who was the coordinator of the Al-Qaeda and Taliban monitoring team at the United Nations in New York, joins us to discuss what might be achieved in tomorrow's meeting about Syria between President Obama and Vladimir Putin, given that Obama thinks Putin is the thug and Putin thinks Obama is a weakling. Then finally, on the one-year anniversary of the disappearance of 43 students in Mexico, we will go to Mexico City to speak with Ryan Devereaux, who covers national security and criminal justice for The Intercept, where his latest article is Disappearances in Mexico, One Year Later, New Theories, But Few Answers. We will discuss yesterday's demonstration by tens of thousands that was led by the parents of the missing students, protesting the government's official finding from an inquiry that few Mexicans believe explains what really happened to the missing students. And joining us now is Mike Lofgren, who has spent 28 years working in Congress, the last 16 as a senior analyst on the House and Senate budget committees, which gave him ringside seats on TARP, Hurricane Katrina disaster relief, debates on the Pentagon budget, and the amazing antics of various deficit reduction commissions. He's the author of The Party Is Over, How Republicans Went Crazy, Democrats Became Useless, and the Middle Class Got Shafted. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mike Lofgren.
Good to be here again.
And Mike, John Boehner got shafted, or at least he fell on his sword, the day after he hosted Pope Francis's historic visit to the Capitol. And the Freedom Caucus, otherwise known as the Tea Party, clearly were just too much for him. They're threatening a government shutdown. Is Boehner's exit avoiding a government shutdown? Is there any way that he's got another month to go, that the Tea Party could push us to the brink again over their insistence on defunding Planned Parenthood?
Well, I don't know that it ends the problem. It may just defer it. He may have figured out a way to avoid the shutdown on September 30th, October 1st, but then he'll be gone, and it just defers the problem until early December. And we'll have the same shutdown problem just before Christmas. So it would be kind of a replay of what we went through in 1995 when Newt shut down the government through the Christmas of 1995 and into January of the following year. Now, when I saw the Pope's address and sort of Boehner letting go with the waterworks there and choking up, I thought, well, maybe he'd had, a stiff one at breakfast or something. But it was obvious that something was going on in retrospect, that was his swan song. And oddly enough, a couple of hours later that same day, I had heard a rumor secondhand from a lobbyist that Boehner would resign. And you'll note that he said, well, he didn't really figure it out until the next day when he woke up and nobody else knew, and he had to tell Kevin McCarthy a couple of times before it sank in. And what this tells me is sort of the deep state aspect of Washington about who really runs things who really knows things. Lobbyists find out about things before the Hill staffers do, or even the members.
And in this case, Kevin McCarthy being the next in line, you'd think he'd be the first to know.
Correct. Mm. And he may well have been the first to know directly among the members, but somehow the lobbyists got wind of this.
And McCarthy, of course, being a Californian, how's his standing with the Tea Party? I mean, my understanding is he's a global warming denier. I know he's out here in California. He's insisting on giving more water to agribusiness during this incredibly devastating drought, which is certainly not playing well, certainly with Governor Brown. What's your understanding about him? How far to the right is he?
Well, that said, by modern Republican standards, he's not particularly conservative. He's no more conservative than is his predecessor, or presumed predecessor, Mr. Boehner.
Well, but Boehner was conservative by any reasonable measure. That's what's so strange.
But he did not meet standards of the Tea Party, and he was probably a country club Republican in the sense that the ideological struggle did not consume him 110%, and he was willing to make a deal and to compromise, and that meant he was a heretic. And what we're going through with the Republican Party is a kind of Lord of the Flies thing. You know, they couldn't take out Obama, so they're going to cannibalize their own. And one thing the listeners to this show might consider is, most people don't understand this, but you do not have to be a member of Congress to be the speaker. It does not specify in the Constitution that you must be a member of Congress. So I'm thinking, in line with their current party situation, maybe they'll choose Kim Davis, the clerk from Kentucky, as their next speaker, or perhaps Phil Robertson of Duck Dynasty. That would be very appropriate for the sort of ideological thinking that's going on these days.
And again, I'm speaking with Mike Loughran, who has spent 28 years in Congress, the last 16 as a senior analyst on the House and Senate budget committees, which gave him ringside seats on TARP, Hurricane Katrina disaster relief, debates on the Pentagon budget, and the amazing antics of various deficit reduction commissions. He's the author of The Party Is Over, How Republicans Went Crazy, Democrats Became Useless, and the Middle Class Got Shafted. But of course, the speaker is the first office laid down in the U.S. Constitution before the president, and it seems to be, at this point, a job that nobody wants. And the idea that you can't, as a Speaker of the House, make a deal, and I guess the same applies to McConnell over in the Senate as well, is crazy. I mean, that's their job, to make a deal. That's the way the Founding Fathers imagined. The separation of powers doesn't mean that all three branches sit in their castles and bring up the drawbridge and fill up the moat and refuse to talk to the other castle, if you will.
Well, the days of Sam Rayburn, I guess, are definitively over. And it, as I said before, it truly is the worst job in Washington, because there's anywhere from 4 to 5 dozen House Republicans who, of course, hold the balance of the majority. If they go, then the speaker doesn't have a majority among Republicans, who are basically the hell no caucus, and they cannot be controlled by the speaker, because the current situation with House seats, the way they're gerrymandered, and the way the ideological situation is with Republicans, they're never going to face a Democratic challenger who could defeat them in an election. The only challenge they'll face is in a primary from further to the right. So basically, all the emoluments like earmarks or committee assignments or money that used to control members simply doesn't work anymore in the current Republican establishment in the House.
Well, the political scientist Tom Ferguson did a lot of research on the Tea Party and who funded it. And, you know, you mentioned the deep state and the lobbyists knowing what's happening before anybody else on the Hill. The lobbyists, of course, work for, you know, the biggest lobbying is Wall Street. There's no question. The banking lobby is the most ubiquitous and most powerful, perhaps, you know, second only to the military-industrial complex. So the question is, what were these Wall Streeters thinking about when they funded this insurgency on the right, on the far right in the Republican Party? What's the end game? I mean, do they have buyer's remorse, or what were they thinking?
Well, for every, corporate launch, like the Apple iPad or the Mac, you have an Edsel or a new Coke. I mean, these people simply calculated on the basis of ideology that these people were fanatical free market fundamentalists who wanted to privatize everything and didn't believe in regulation, and that's kind of Wall Street's ethos as well. But they did not sort of calculate all the kind of cultural and ideological baggage that goes with that, such as shutting down the government and running the country into a credit default and all the other crazy stuff they want to do. So perhaps they did get buyer's remorse. You do see that from the U.S. Chamber of Commerce now, but of course, most of us will not feel a great deal of sympathy for their dilemma.
Well, clearly you have the fact that Donald Trump and Ben Carson are leading in the Republican presidential primaries. That's got to even make the Wall Streeters, the free marketeers. I understand the logic of having this cadre of hardliners on the far right of the Republican Party who can do and say things that most traditional Republicans, you know, as much as they trash government, at least they believe in some kind of government function. When you have people that just want to basically get rid of every regulation there is and unleash the free market, I can see why they supported these people, because nobody else would say this stuff and push that agenda. And now it's completely out in the open. And now the craziest stuff has become a mainstream debating point. I mean, they've had an extraordinary effect on moving the political debate right into the far right stratosphere.
Well, absolutely. And to draw a historical parallel, I know it's a grave violation of Godwin's law to bring this up, but in Weimar Germany, the big steel magnates like Fritz Thyssen and the big propagandists and publishing magnates like Alfred Hugenberg, who was kind of the Rupert Murdoch of Germany in the Weimar Republic, thought they could use and channel the Nazi Party for their own ends, to smash the labor unions and destroy the social democrats, but that they could control them. Well, they got more than they bargained for.
So what's the situation then? Is this sort of nihilistic tail that wags the dog of the Republican Party, the Tea Party, or as they prefer to call themselves, the Freedom Caucus, are they just going to march down the road of self-marginalization?
Well, it would appear so, but they can cause a lot of damage to the furniture on their way out. So I won't make any predictions about the course of this little drama.
You don't see a crack up of the Republican Party in the future?
Not anytime soon. Ever since Joe McCarthy in the early 50s, and once he got censured, all the wise men in the media said, well, the Republican Party has to become moderate. And then in 64, we got the Goldwater insurgency. They got thrashed. They made the same statements, the media and the wise men and the pundits did. Then we ended up with Nixon and the Southern Strategy, then Watergate. But no matter what the disaster, they always dust themselves off. They say it was because they were not conservative enough. And a few years later, they ride that success. So I'm not sure that this is the end.
Well, my understanding is that what's going on with the Republican primary voters, and it's a very small minority of the American people who are now dominating the headlines and fighting over this Republican primary prize, which, again, Trump and Carson are ahead of the rest of the pack, is this whole idea that you've got the situation with the rest of rank and file who we're told are frustrated that they invite these guys in, the GOP and the Tea Party people, and nothing gets done. And they're particularly angry at the so-called rhinos, Republicans in name only, who they think are selling them out. But at the end of the day, it may be that their bark is worse than their bite. And I noticed that Jeb Bush and others still are trying to hoist this canard that the other party, the Democratic Party, is all about just buying votes and throwing goodies at minorities, which is what Jeb Bush said the other day. So this is the fact that they feel that their people haven't been able to defeat Obama, who they clearly hate, seems to be at the heart of it. But do they understand that maybe the majority of Americans don't agree with them?
Well, that may be well true, but let me help you out here. There's also this problem we have based on the way districts are structured, the way the Constitution is based, that does not give, sort of absolute majority rule, and things that have now been enshrined in law, apparently, by the Supreme Court regarding campaign finance, that, as well as things like vote suppression, once you get a majority in a state legislature, that never mind if they're a minority, they still have the structural ability to win, or if not to win, to certainly cause trouble by ensuring continued gridlock.
Well, but that's what's paradoxical about this. What they're complaining about is they've got the House and Senate, and somehow Boehner and McConnell can't deliver, and Obama is running rings around them. So that's the opposite of what you're saying.
Well, nevertheless, they have the House and Senate, and Obama can do certain things, but he can't get, for instance, his budget passed. There's a lot of things he can't do. Now, I'm glad he managed to sneak through the Iran nuclear agreement, but by far he has not succeeded in putting through all the things he would have wanted to do and that he could have done with a Congress that was more agreeable to him. And we also were facing these things like shutdowns, which is simply not the status quo in a country that is the biggest economic and military power in the world. Why is it being run like a banana republic?
Well, on that note, Mike Lufkin, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Appreciated being here.
And again, I've been speaking with Mike Lufkin, who spent 28 years in Congress, the last 16 as a senior analyst on the House and Senate budget committees, which gave him ringside seats on top, Hurricane Katrina disaster relief, debates on the Pentagon budget, and the amazing antics of various deficit reduction commissions. He is the author of The Party Is Over, How Republicans Went Crazy, Democrats Became Useless, and the Middle Class Got Shafted. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back examining the continuing growth of ISIS and the upcoming meeting between Obama and Vladimir Putin over Syria at the United Nations. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Richard Barrett, who's the director of the Sufan Group, a New York-based security consultancy company. He sits on the boards of the International Center for Counterterrorism in The Hague and the Center on Global Counterterrorism Cooperation in Washington, and was the coordinator of the Al-Qaeda and Taliban monitoring team at the United Nations in New York, appointed by the UN Secretary General. And he helped establish a system-wide United Nations Working Group on Terrorism, which became the United Nations Counterterrorism Implementation Task Force. Welcome to Background Briefing, Richard Barrett.
Thank you very much, Ian.
And the President Obama and Vladimir Putin are meeting tomorrow at the UN to talk about Syria. And given that Obama thinks Putin is a thug and Putin thinks Obama is a weakling, do you think they can get past that and get something done?
Well, yeah, I guess they have to, because it's really important for both of them that they do get past that. I mean, a lot of this is for domestic consumption, of course, and Putin no less than Obama, and Obama no less than Putin. And that President Putin needs to show people in Russia that all the ills that are besetting the country at the moment, internally for the economy and the exchange rate for the ruble and the state of the infrastructure and everything, all that sort of thing is really sort of not what he's about. He's about solving world problems. And Syria is a big world problem and a very important one for Russia. Certainly, I think, quite as important as it is for the United States.
But clearly, Putin is trying to leverage himself into being part of the solution in Syria when he's been part of the problem all along. At least that's how the West sees it. So what is the room to maneuver here between Putin saying, I can join in the battle against the Islamic State, but the condition is that Assad's have got to stay in power, Putin just announced that overthrowing Assad would lead to a failed state?
Well, yes, that's right. I mean, the point of convergence is exactly on trying to defeat the Islamic State. And the point of difference is in the future of Assad and the way Syria should be governed beyond Assad and when that would happen. But on the issue of the Islamic State, I think there is a real agreement that something should be done. But the problem for the United States is that the Russian argument that the best partner in dealing with the Islamic State, particularly in Syria, is the Syrian army, really that argument leads to, well, you need to reinforce Assad in order to be able to reinforce the Syrian army. And if you reinforce the Syrian army, of course, you reinforce Assad. Whereas the Americans would say, no, we have to attack the Islamic State, but we don't want anything to do with Assad because Assad is indeed part of the problem. So here, I think, is the difficulty of the negotiation. Can there be an agreement between them that the problem presented by the Islamic State is so great that they should sort of reach some compromise on the future of Assad? And the Americans, I think, would like to say, okay, let him stay for a limited period of time, but it has to be very limited. And after that, there has to be a proper transition to a new government. Whereas the Russians would say, you can't prejudge what the Syrian people should want, and you can't prejudge, indeed, what the situation will be once the Islamic State is defeated. But it's the Islamic State defeat we have to focus on in the first instance.
Well, the fact that, at least according to Sunday's New York Times, that nearly 30,000 foreign recruits have poured into Syria to join the Islamic State, which doubles the number of volunteers in just the past 12 months. And among them, apparently, there are more than 250 Americans, which is up from 100 Americans a year ago, would indicate that the Islamic State is on the move. We know that Assad has lost 85% of his territory. Those are pretty alarming statistics.
Well, they are, but I think we have to keep them in context. I mean, the New York Times report, of course, is a great report, as you'd expect. But nonetheless, this 250 figure, first of all, it's of all people who've attempted to go, as well as who've managed to get there. And I don't think we need necessarily see it as a stark increase on the figures of last year, because I think the figures of last year, as indeed of this year, are guesses as much as anything else. And I think there's just more information available now than there was then as to suggest how many people have actually gone. So that sort of comparison with last year, I think, is a little bit in doubt. And the second thing to remember here is that, okay, we have a country here of, what, 260 million people, which maybe 250 have tried to get to the Islamic State. In Russia, there are over 2,400 people who joined the Islamic State, and that's an official estimate, which I think is also underplays the exact figure. So actually, potentially for Russia, this is a much bigger problem than it is for the United States, whereas here I think the authorities are pretty much on top of people who are planning to mount attacks. We've had one or two, awfully unfortunate, of course, they can't stop them all. But as for returnees coming back from the Islamic State, I haven't seen any evidence of that here, whereas in Russia, I think several people have gone back to the Caucasus and are now fighting with what is indeed an Islamic State province in the Caucasus against the Russian authorities there.
And again, I'm speaking with Richard Barrett, who's the director of the Sufan Group, a New York-based security consultancy company. He sits on the boards of the International Center for Counterterrorism in The Hague and the Center on Global Counterterrorism Cooperation in Washington, and he was the coordinator of the Al-Qaeda and Taliban monitoring team at the United Nations in New York. But the Pentagon is reporting that the coalition have killed about 10,000 Islamic State fighters. But we're also told, or there are news reports, that there's some friction within the ranks of the U.S. military intelligence analysts who feel that their assessments are being sanitized by the top brass to make it appear that U.S. efforts to degrade and destroy ISIS are more successful than the reality on the ground indicates. What's your reading on this?
Well, again, it's hard to tell what's actually going on inside the Islamic State, but I think that there is an actual tension there between what the military reckon to be achieving by the military activity and what non-military reckon to be the actual situation on the ground. It is absolutely clear, and I'm sure all military would agree with this, that we cannot bomb and shoot the Islamic State out of existence. There has to be much more than that in order to be able to eradicate it completely. It's just impossible to kill everybody, particularly if you're trying to avoid civilian casualties. Of course, the Islamic State is very much involved within the population generally over a large area of Syria, as you say, and indeed of Iraq as well. So there has to be something else done. And I think the assessment of the distance between achieving that final eradication of the Islamic State and the sort of containing it that's the result of the military action is where the differences of opinion arise, because it's impossible, in my view, to eradicate the Islamic State completely unless there's something viable to replace it. And there isn't anything at the moment. The people who live in that area will not accept the Assad government back to rule their lives. They had a pretty, you know, bad rap when the Syrian administration was in control of that area, and they didn't want to go back to that. So the Islamic State may be bad, but there isn't an obviously better alternative. And until that alternative emerges, I think it's hard for any analyst to say that a purely military campaign will succeed in destroying the Islamic State completely.
Well, meanwhile, it seems that the, for example, Damascus itself is under threat, and there's a tremendous exodus of refugees. Many of the refugees showing up in Greece, risking their lives crossing the Mediterranean, have identified themselves as coming from Damascus. And this whole refugee flow, of course, is now affecting politics in Europe, and it's indeed creating a kind of fissure between Western Europe and Eastern Europe. And to some extent, that seems to be playing into Putin's hand, in as much as he's kind of a spoiler. I know that he funds right-wing parties in France, for example, and he also is very close to Viktor Orban, the Prime Minister of Hungary, who is taking a very hard line against the immigrants. So do you see a dimension there? Because it seems to me that this refugee crisis is just going to get worse.
Well, Putin is, of course, an opportunist in this sense as well. Yeah, he certainly will be shedding no tears at all about the problems of Western Europe in trying to absorb this enormous flow of refugees. He'll be delighted by that. To a certain extent, it puts Ukraine, the problems of Ukraine, very much in the distance as well. And everyone is forgetting about that because of this refugee problem now in Europe. But at the same time, I think Assad is, as you say, very weak in Damascus, and these people are voting with their feet. They don't have any confidence that he's able to reassert authority in a way that they would like. And if he goes, of course, what's going to happen to them? It's probably better to get out while you can. But in reality, although Assad, I think, was at one point prepared to move off to Latakia, to the sort of heartland of the Alawite regime on the Mediterranean coast in Syria, and sort of almost abandoned Damascus, I think both the Iranians and the Russians saw that as inimical to their own interests, because they need Damascus, they need that capital to be under the control of Assad in order to be able to expand or just maintain their own regional influences. So I think that Assad sort of talk about, well, I may have to leave Damascus, was a way to bring Russia and Iran even more closer to his support. And in the meantime, as you say, you know, Europe is suffering, the rest of the world is suffering, and of course, Syrian civilians in particular are suffering.
But, and of course, the Russians are building up their air base at Latakia, and they have the naval base at Tartus. Is this, as most analysts say, at the end of the day, really about Russia wanting to hold on to its foothold? And if that's their motive in supporting Assad, what's the Iranian motive?
Well, yeah, I think you're right. First of all, on the Russian point of view, yes, certainly they want to build up their own influence in the region. They don't really have another foothold in the Middle East apart from Syria, but they've been trying hard, of course, to extend relations with Saudi Arabia and some of the other Gulf states. But Syria is really where they can establish themselves, and it's through the future of Syria that they'll be able to influence things in a region which until now, I think, has been pretty much the preserve of the United States. For Iran, Iran's main interest, of course, is in maintaining a close relationship with Hezbollah, to be able to maintain Hezbollah influence in Lebanon. That's a really, really important objective for Iran. And that supply route is essentially through Damascus. It's through Syria. Now, it also helps, of course, that Iran has considerable influence in Baghdad and in Damascus. But I think Lebanon is where their long-term strategic interests probably most lie. And that, of course, also has to be seen in terms of their competition with other Gulf states. So I think both Russia and Iran see a great interest in preserving Assad, but they do understand that within that they have to negotiate with the United States and Turkey and the Gulf states, particularly Saudi Arabia, in order to be able to get some sort of stability there which doesn't put their own interests in jeopardy over the long term.
Well, you mentioned, Richard Barrett, Saudi Arabia and the Russians trying to, build bridges, if you will. This disaster in Mecca with the Hajj is certainly, given how much there is in this quagmire down in Yemen, where you've got one of the richest countries in the world bombing the hell out of one of the poorest, and apparently the whole kingdom now is being run by this 30-year-old kid. I'm hearing reports that Saudi Arabia may crack up. Has that ever come across your radar?
Well, I think everybody's been sort of looking at the underpinnings of the monarchy in Saudi Arabia for some time, because to a certain extent it's held together by two things. First of all, the money it has to be able to sort of pay off the population, if you like, so that people can live in relative comfort. And second, by the sort of hierarchical approach of the country, fed by their sort of interpretation of Islam, which makes the king sort of the key authority throughout the whole state. Well, both those things are slightly under threat at the moment, because on the economic side, the price of oil is so low that it's, and the cost of the wars, particularly in Yemen, are so high that Saudi Arabia is running through its reserves. And I don't think a couple of years ago anyone would have thought anyone would be worried about Saudi Arabia running through its reserves, which, of course, run into the billions. But they are, and the money can't go on indefinitely like that. Second, on the religious side, I think now, because of the sort of teachings that are put out generally through Saudi schools and Saudi education, the appeal of the Islamic State is actually quite strong. It resonates quite well with people in Saudi Arabia. And so there's a danger there, I think, for the monarchy, that they may see the public drifting away from automatic support of the king and his family and feeling, well, maybe society should be run in a different way. So I think that although I wouldn't say Saudi Arabia is going to collapse tomorrow, I think that the ruling family must be concerned about the medium to long term.
Well, Richard Barrett, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Richard Barrett, who's the director of the Sufan Group, a New York-based security consultancy company. He sits on the boards of the International Center for Counterterrorism in The Hague and the Center on Global Counterterrorism Cooperation in Washington. And he was the coordinator of the Al-Qaeda and Taliban monitoring team at the United Nations in New York. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back talking about the one-year anniversary of the disappearance of 43 students in Mexico.
Strikes now, so it would strike anyway.
¿Cuánto tiempo va a pasar para que pueda mejorar? Todos somos víctimas de un estado confiscado, con un gobierno involucrado en las ganancias del narco. Es una nación podrida con la población herida.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now from Mexico City is Ryan Devereaux, who's a Brooklyn-based journalist covering national security and criminal justice for The Intercept. His work has appeared in The Guardian, Rolling Stone, The Nation, The Village Voice, and his latest article at The Intercept is Disappearances in Mexico, 1 year later, New Theories but Few Answers. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ryan Devereaux.
Thanks for having me.
And Ryan, there yesterday in Mexico City, there tens of thousands marched in protest of the government's inability to make any sense about what happened to these 43 trainee teachers that went missing in Iguala exactly 1 year ago. It's become a national bleeding wound, if you will. It really seems to have struck the consciousness of all Mexicans, or most Mexicans. And yet you've got this divide between the people and the government that's never more stark. I mean, nobody believes the government's version of things, do they?
No, the government's version is pretty widely discounted here. Yesterday's march, I think, was a lot larger than a lot of people expected. There was a real question as to whether or not people would turn out in large numbers, whether or not there was fatigue. But yesterday's march was pretty massive. It wasn't the largest that we've seen in Mexico City over the course of this story, but it was still, even a year on, you know, as you said, tens of thousands of people in the streets, in the rain, marching with the parents at the head of the march. So there's still just a ton of frustration and a ton of anger here, and a lot of cynicism as well. I mean, there are a lot of doubts as to whether or not this will ever be resolved. But the anger and the frustration is very palpable, and you can still see it in the streets here. You can see the number 43 spray painted on on walls and columns everywhere around the centro here in Mexico City. I mean, it's something we can still very much feel.
Well, when we last spoke a while back, Ryan, you had been doing investigations into possible alternative theories to the discredited government theory.
Mm-hmm.
And the only evidence that they provided is some bone fragments at a dump in the forests of Guerrero, where supposedly one of the killers had told the authorities that they had burned the bodies. And most forensic experts say that the evidence just doesn't wash. You also talked to me a lot about the role of the military in the actual incidents that took place when the students seized the buses and then were shot at by the local police, who shot indiscriminately. But the military were very much a presence, and there was a suggestion that maybe the military were involved and that there was a big incinerator at the local military base that may explain why the bodies of these 43 have completely vanished. So walk us through some of the alternatives that you've written about in your new article at The Intercept, Disappearances mm-hmm. in Mexico 1 year Later, New Theories But Few Answers.
Yeah, so important thing to understand about this case is just a few weeks back, the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights, which had appointed a committee of independent experts to examine this case, published their findings of a sort of six-month investigation into the government's investigation. It's a 560-page report. It's incredibly thorough and detailed, and quite damning, actually, in its scope and its detail. And this report really, in a lot of ways, confirmed the work that I did when I was here last winter, an investigation that we did for The Intercept, investigations that a lot of journalists have done here in Mexico into the disappearance of the students. And it did pose some new theories as to the military. What the report found, which was consistent with what I found, which was consistent with what a lot of journalists have found, is that at the very least, the military failed to intervene and failed to stop the violence that night, and in fact was aware of what was going on throughout the course of the evening as these students were under attack in nine different locations. You know, this was, what the report found was that this was a coordinated attack on the students that involved security forces at every single level in Iguala. We're talking about municipal police, state police, federal police, and the military. The municipal police were the principal aggressors in the attack, according to the report and according to my reporting and the reporting of other journalists. But these other security forces, state, federal, the military, they were there as well, and they knew what was going on as it was happening. The town was essentially on lockdown, people terrified in their homes, amounts of shooting at these unarmed students. And so the question that the report sought to answer, this Inter-American Commission report, was why? Why, it's the question that we've all been asking for the last year, why would this happen? There's still no answers, but the report did raise a theory that's chilling and intriguing, and that is that the students may have inadvertently commandeered a bus. Commandeering buses is something that these radical students, these rural teaching colleges, the students that attend them, they do this quite often. It's typically nonviolent. But that night in Iguala, as the theory goes, the students may have grabbed a bus that was loaded with drugs, most likely heroin, and or money bound for the United States. Iguala, Guerrero, the state of Guerrero, is a major heroin trafficking hub. It's the country's largest opium-producing state. So the idea is that potentially what happened is these students, without knowing it, got onto a bus that was taking a shipment of drugs north. And the local security establishment wouldn't stand for that. And so they clamped down extremely hard. And the attack was really about controlling any buses that were attempting to leave the city. We had multiple attacks in multiple locations. You had an attack on a bus that was carrying innocent people who had nothing to do with the students. So So there's a possibility, according to this report, and a lot of journalists here think it's potentially credible, that what happened was the students just were on the wrong bus at the wrong time, and they got in the middle of a shipment in a place where the security forces and the criminal groups have, you know, long been mixed. And I think that if that is the case, it's a really sort of damning indictment of, you know, the sort of consequences of the drug war that we see in Mexico playing out, and we have seen playing out since 2006.
And again, I'm speaking with Ryan Devereaux, who is in Mexico City. He's a Brooklyn-based journalist covering national security and criminal justice for The Intercept, and his work has appeared in The Guardian, Rolling Stone, The Nation, The Village Voice, and his latest article at The Intercept is Disappearances in Mexico 1 Year Later, New Theories But Few Answers. Well, I brought up the military only because they are, you would think that because this cover-up has been so tight and that the government has basically tried to just quell this story so assiduously that you'd think that it would take, you know, an institution like that in the criminal world, you can always shake people down. And much of the evidence so far, for what it's worth, has come from members of the drug gang that were associated with the mayor of Iguala and his wife. So is that an understandable suspicion on my part?
Yeah, I think what's important to understand about the state of Guerrero specifically is that this is the state where the so-called dirty war in Mexico in the 60s and 70s was most intense. This is a place where the military executed an extremely aggressive campaign at rooting out, you know, sort of guerrilla fighters that existed in the state that were challenging the government. And those guerrilla groups, a lot of them were graduates of schools like Ayotzinapa, the college that these students attended. In fact, the most famous guerrilla fighter in Mexican history actually attended Ayotzinapa, this very school. And so there's been, for a long, long time, a sort of animosity towards these schools and these students on the part of the military in Iguala. I'm sorry, in Guerrero. And during that entire period, hundreds of people disappeared, torture and extrajudicial killings. Nobody was brought to justice. And that sort of level of cover-up and that sort of history is still very alive and felt in a place like Guerrero. And so the idea that the military would be able to cover up something like this isn't unprecedented in any way. For decades, they've managed to enjoy impunity for a whole host of crimes during the dirty war, and the sort of tension that exists between military forces there and the sort of radical elements, the teachers, it's quite intense, and it's very, very real.
So in terms of yesterday's demonstration in the streets of Mexico City, where tens of thousands protested, the protest being led by the parents of these 43 students that have been missing now for a year, and this is an incident that has grabbed the attention of the country, even though there's been something like 100,000 people killed in the so-called drug wars, at least, and there's multiple disappearances. This, for some reason or other, has really stuck in, you know, really almost like the straw that broke the camel's back as far as the people are concerned, and it's made life difficult for Peña Nieto. But, of course, he just seems to be such a joke. I mean, his trip to France with a huge delegation when the stories back home blew up in his face. I mean, he seems to be such an example of this out-of-touch political elite.
Yeah, that's the thing with this story. And the expression in Mexico is the drop that spilled the glass. And speaking to people in Iguala, that phrase came up over and over again. And this case has come to sort of symbolize this just immense, immense lack of credibility that the administration here has, the federal government has, the security forces at every level have. I mean, this case, you really can't understate how symbolic it's been. It's something about it, the timing and the way in which it was just so blatantly the government that attacked a number of unarmed students. it just triggered an incredible reaction. And it came to, you know, represent years and years of people being disappeared and cases being left unsolved and families frustrated with no answers. And an entire country has watched the sort of story that has played out in, you know, so many communities across Mexico every day for years and years, play out on a national level, you know, on television every single day, just a reminder of how sort of corrupt and inept many, many elements of the government here are.
Well, I was referring to when Peña Nieto took this big state visit to France with a huge delegation of 400-plus retainers. It coincided with El Chapo Guzman escaping or being let out of prison. And now, of course, some heads have rolled. And it was pretty obvious at the time that the idea that you could build a mile-long tunnel right to his cell, why did they put him on the ground floor? It just reeks of, I mean, I imagine, I can understand why the average citizen is just saying, well, the system is so rigged.
Well, you look at the last year or so here, and, you know, you have this army massacre, this Tlatlaya massacre, in which the army sort of covered up the killing of a number of people that they had detained who were initially, you know, the initial story was that they were criminals. As it turns out, that wasn't the case, wasn't entirely the case. They executed a number of people. And then we have Iguala right after that. We have another massacre with federal police and other security forces in the state of Michoacan, where Peña Nieto has had to deal with so-called self-defense groups rising up against cartels. Then we have Chapo escaping. We have, a sort of a journalist murdered, along with a prominent activist and other women here in Mexico City, with just the latest in a string of journalists to be murdered from the state of Veracruz, where, you have this governor who's sort of publicly threatening journalists, and journalists are dying left and right. I mean, it's been a year here where people are just incredibly fed up and angry and disappointed at at the state of their government.
So have you obviously talked to fellow journalists. Do they feel threatened? I think the Committee to Protect Journalists have done a worldwide survey, and I think Mexico is the most dangerous place to report in.
The feeling among journalists here, I have to say, there's just an incredible sort of group of journalists that exist in Mexico City that do amazing, amazing work in the face of, really serious, serious threats. They've managed, at virtually every turn when it comes to important information that's been uncovered about the IOC and Alpha case, it's been journalists who have been, going door to door, talking to people, using this sort of freedom of information law here in Mexico to gather documents, to pry documents away from the government. The journalists here do feel threatened. I mean, it's dangerous to be a journalist in Mexico. And that's not so much for someone like me who just comes in from New York, but for the Mexican journalists that are here that are poking and prodding at the state. There is a serious danger, but they do it nonetheless. And it's pretty awe-inspiring.
Well, but just in terms of on the political level, it does seem pretty hopeless, doesn't it, in terms of the political opposition? I understand one of the reasons why the PRI came back after being in exile, the 70-plus year-long rule of the Revolutionary Institutional Party, which is in itself a kind of paradox. They became like the Communist Party of the Soviet Union, and an entrenched and corrupt, crumbling edifice, and they finally went out of business. And then the right-wing party, the PAN, came in, and they enthusiastically prosecuted the war on drugs, which has led to all of this, or at least it contributed to all this mayhem. They got booted out. But the other party, the PRD, which is the leftist party, that's always have their election stolen from them, would seem, it's the PRD people down in Guerrero who are responsible for the disappearance of these students. So they're completely sullied, aren't they?
Yeah. I mean, speaking to people here, you don't see the political parties, whether it's PRI or PRD, draw sort of equal levels of frustration from folks, especially in places like Guerrero. you know, and among journalists here in Mexico City, it's sort of seen as the political parties are all sort of seen as part of this, the same machine. And, you know, you sort of raise the question of whether or not it's hopeless. And, you know, there are a ton of people here in this country who are working to make it a better country. You know, so it's, I don't want to say that it's hopeless, but at the same time, there are so many challenges to overcome in sort of uprooting the deeply, deeply entrenched corruption that exists in large parts of the country and in some of the most important, you know, areas of government. I don't see it changing without real fundamental structural changes here in Mexico, and then also, you know, key changes would have to happen in the United States. Well, you know, the United States is a country that is responsible for a ton of weapons flowing over the border into Mexico. You know, our policies on drugs, of course, have helped to sort of fuel just a massive crisis in Latin America and places like Mexico. And, you know, until that changes, I don't see this status quo being shifted in any significant way.
Well, just in closing, in our political dialogue here, as we just criticized politics in Mexico, we have Donald Trump and Ben Carson and all these ignorant nativists saying the most outrageous things about Mexico.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there is a complete and total, I don't know even how to describe it, a lack of understanding in the United States and, you know, in large parts of the population about what's going on in Mexico and what kind of place it is and why there is violence here and how sort of intertwined it is with policies in the United States. I think that obviously, you know, somebody like Donald Trump, you know, he plays to the politics of fear and about Mexico. And yes, there's violence here, but it's an incredible country. It's a beautiful country and people would like it to see it much, much better. And you don't have this sort of situation that exists in Mexico right now without a lot of policies that exist in the United States. They're just so bound up in one another. The drug war that has been led, by the United States, that the United States has, you know, funneled billions of dollars into Mexico to fight, is in large part, you know, totally responsible for the violence that we see right now. And so until there's a reckoning where people in the United States understand how deeply we are involved in the situation that exists here, I don't think that we'll see much change.
Well, Ron Devereaux, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
And again, I've been speaking with Ron Devereaux, who's in Mexico City. He's a Brooklyn-based journalist covering national security and criminal justice for The Intercept. His work has appeared at The Guardian, Rolling Stone, The Nation, The Village Voice, and his latest article at The Intercept is Disappearances in Mexico 1 year Later, New Theories but Few Answers. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.